Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2023. We have six cases on our calendar today. Four are set for oral argument, the first of which is A21-1228, State of Minnesota versus Derek Michael Chauvin. Counsel for appellant, that's seated to my left here. You will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes for your arguments. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes after that for rebuttal, if you so choose. We have the podium in the middle. There is a button on the lower part to lower and raise the podium, and you can also adjust the microphone. There is a timer there. Please be mindful of the amount of time that you have to stay within your time limits. We are allowing this to be live streamed and to be recorded. However, no other recordings are allowed, and we will be recording the audio version of this hearing as well. That will be available within a few days for counsel. Also, counsel, when you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and your party you're representing. Will any party be splitting any time with any other counsel at all? Yes, will counsel for either party be splitting time with anyone else? No, Your Honor. Okay, thank you very much. With that, counsel for appellant, you may approach the podium and begin your arguments.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is William Mormon. I represent appellant Derek Chauvin. May it please the court, counsel. I do want to note, unfortunately, before I begin my argument, I had an oral argument before the Court of Appeals last week, and it wasn't a big problem in that courtroom, but it is here. 8 years ago, I lost my hearing in my left ear, so I've got single-sided deafness that may cause some issues hearing things. In addition, when two people are talking, and that can include myself, it all turns into a jumble. So if the court asks me a question in the middle of my argument, which is, of course, legitimate, I may ask you to repeat it.
Not a problem. Feel free to let us know at any time, and we'll make sure to try to speak up as loudly as possible to make sure. But please let us know if you have any issues at all.
I will, and you'll often see me when you talk tilting my head this way, and that's to direct my ear towards you. The primary issue on this appeal is whether a criminal defendant can get a fair trial consistent with constitutional requirements in a courthouse that's surrounded by concrete block, barbed wire, two armored personnel carriers, and a squad of National Guard troops, all of which or whom are there for one purpose in the event that the jury acquits the defendant. I want to begin my argument today, and most of my argument today, focusing on the issue, constitutional issue, of the pervasiveness of the pretrial publicity in this case, combined with a factor that's not often found in cases regarding a fair trial, and that's physical pressure on the courthouse and the courthouse participants.
Counsel, I understand that you want to address that issue, and we certainly want to discuss that one. But before we get to that issue, there's one other I wanted to talk about briefly, and that's with respect to the Schwartz hearing.
Yes.
And would you agree that with respect to jury questioning, that Chauvin had the opportunity to question all of the jurors, including Juror 52?
Yes.
Okay. Would you agree that the district court has, under case law, fairly broad discretion on whether to grant or deny a request for a Schwartz hearing?
Yes.
Okay. And would you agree that case law also recognizes that a district court does not abuse its fairly broad discretion when a defendant has an opportunity to question a juror, even if there is a basis to hold a hearing?
That I don't agree with, because in this case, the juror answered juror questionnaires falsely that were directly relevant to the issues in the case with ferreting out potential juror bias.
But that's a fairly accurate paraphrase from the Stofflet case, that a district court does not abuse its broad discretion when a defendant has an opportunity to question a juror, even if there is a basis to hold a hearing. In other words, we give fairly broad discretion to the district court in terms of its decisions.
That's true. I think there's an exception when you get a false question to a jury questionnaire. I mean, there were four items we pointed out in our brief. The most important one to me is the questionnaire asked whether or not the participants had attended any kind of rallies or protests related to police brutality, and juror 52 attended the rally in Washington.
I don't think rally was the word that was used in that question for the juror. I think the question was protests.
Yes.
And even in Chauvin's briefing below, as well as the briefing to this court, it identified and referred to that as a march, the event in Washington as a march. And there are specific questions that were asked, but in terms of protest in Minneapolis, and he answered no, which was truthful. He didn't.
That's correct.
Yeah. But the question on protests, the broad question of protest did not include the word march. And even Chauvin appeared to acknowledge that that was a march. It wasn't a protest.
I don't see in the context of this case the difference between those two items.
Well, I think it is. Your briefing seems to acknowledge that there is a difference because those two words were not used synonymously. So I don't see how that testimony is false. If
I think in terms of a juror questionnaire, the juror questionnaire would get quite lengthy and wordy if you had to tease out every word like that.
That's what voir dire is for, though, to be able to expand on the questionnaires and ask those probing questions. And case law is clear that the burden for asking those probing questions is on the defendant.
I understand that. I still think in the context of this case, the juror was not forthright in answering that question, yes, and acknowledging that he had attended a rally, protest, march, whatever, in Washington that was directly connected to this case. I'm sorry if I...
No, go ahead.
You seem to want to ask another question on this.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Before we leave the Schwartz hearing issue, assuming we agree that the trial court should have held the Schwartz hearing, what would you propose that we do with this appeal?
That the case be remanded to the court to hold a Schwartz hearing, and that the district court then make decisions based on the Schwartz hearing. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How do we handle the rest of the items of your appeal? Do we wait until there's a Schwartz hearing, or we decide those questions and then expect the Schwartz hearing?
No, you can decide. You certainly can decide the change of venue issue without deciding the Schwartz hearing. I don't see the Schwartz hearing appeal as blocking this court from ruling on the change of venue issue at all. Have I responded to your question, Your Honor?
That's not the only item you raised on appeal.
No,
what do we do with the rest of the issues? The question is it appropriate that we would then remand for a Schwartz hearing and continue this appeal, or decide the questions that we can and then order a Schwartz hearing?
If the court rules in my favor, or my client's favor, on the other issues we've raised on appeal, that means there's going to have to be a new trial. At that point, I don't think we need to have a Schwartz hearing, because the main remedy my client's looking for here is a new trial.
But before you get to a new trial, you have to have a Schwartz hearing first, don't you?
Not if you rule in my... I think Judge Klapiecki was asking me what happens with the other issues related to the Schwartz hearing. If the court concludes that the other issues that Appellant Chauvin has appealed from in this case, that he's correct in those, then the remand back to the district court is to hold a new trial or on the change of venue issue to remand to the district court to determine a new venue and a new trial's held. And you, then you don't need a Schwartz hearing. The whole purpose of a Schwartz hearing is to ferret out if the guilty verdict in the case that's before you was tainted by juror misconduct, and then to go back in a Schwartz hearing and figure that out, and then the remedy from that will be to have a new trial.
And for the Schwartz hearing, the only issue that was raised below, was the only issue with the Schwartz hearing raised below the March on Washington?
No, there were four issues related to the juror questionnaire, including, as you cited, the whether anybody attended a rally in Minneapolis, whether anyone had negative feelings about the Minneapolis Police Department, and the kind of a res gestae question at the end, is there anything else that the court should be aware of?
Where in the record were those issues raised to the district court? It appeared that the only one that was actually raised to the district court was the one on the March on Washington.
I believe the one was raised also with the police department, but I don't have the exact citation with me right now to that.
But he had been, juror 52 had been questioned extensively on those issues, including what he thought of Black Lives Matters, what he thought of Blue Lives Matters. So there, he had been thoroughly questioned on those yeah. issues, correct?
He had been questioned by counsel on the issues, correct.
And answered very straightforward that he thought Black Lives Matters was important.
That's correct.
That black and racially and ethnically diverse people were not necessarily treated fairly by the police. He thought that Blue Lives Matters was a response to the Black Lives Matter. So he seemed pretty forthright on all those issues. So why, I'm having a hard time understanding how he was not forthright at all in terms of answering any of the questions.
Because if he would have revealed the issues about the March rally protest in Washington, it would have prompted other questions from counsel.
Which goes back to, isn't it counsel's duty to ferret out those questions and ask those probing questions?
And what I would say, you're kind of identifying a chicken-egg thing. And I think if jurors are not fully forthright in the juror questionnaire, then it's not possible for counsel to know to inquire into those areas in any depth.
Which goes back to the standard of review that we have, which is very deferential. We're only an error-correcting court, and we give great deference to the district court's discretion, which here is very broad, to deny it, even if there are reasons, if there is an opportunity by the defendant to ask those questions.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I want to get back to the, obviously, to the pretrial publicity and pressure on the courthouse issue. As we laid out in our papers, the court's to engage in a two-stage analysis or two-tier analysis regarding changing venue. And under the first tier, the court's to determine from the totality of the circumstances whether or not the pretrial publicity or any other factors are such that prejudice is presumed in the jury pool in the community where the case is going to be tried. And then after clearing that issue, you go to the second issue, which is to determine whether or not there was any actual prejudice. Our primary argument here is that this case could not be tried in Minneapolis because of the pretrial publicity, which was pervasive from Memorial Day onward through the trial, and also just the physical pressure on the courthouse. I've laid out in our brief the amount of concerns that the jurors had for their safety. That was all articulated to the judge during voir dire. In fact, Judge Cale acknowledged a number of times on the record that all the jurors had expressed concerns regarding their own safety. With regard to the trial itself, I believe it was 5 days before closing arguments, the governor ordered the deployment of the National Guard throughout the city. And that was deployment, again, was ordered because of the upcoming verdict and the concern that if there was an acquittal, there could be riots again. And under the case law that we've cited, I think what makes this case really unique is, again, the riots that occurred. because there's no there's a few cases. We cited two in our briefing to the court where you had courts either order a change of venue in the Lozano case or in the Nevers case, which was a habeas petition. The court released a police officer who was tried regarding an incident that occurred in Detroit, where the court laid out that the jury was, the court put it bracing for a riot, and that you can't hold a trial in a community where the jurors are looking at the possibility of a riot in the event that the jurors would acquit the defendant.
Has the Minnesota appellate case ever, the appellate court ever in Minnesota, ordered a new trial based upon presumptive prejudicial pretrial publicity?
I couldn't find a case that did, Your Honor. And the state has argued extensively in the response brief that this two-tiered analysis I've laid out under federal law, under the federal constitution, somehow doesn't hold in Minnesota. I was very concerned about that issue being raised here today, and in preparing for oral argument, I got onto Westlaw and went searching around for what I could find, and there was a treatise, Criminal Practice Manual. It's called Standard Criminal Practice Manual. At section 33.3, discusses this presumption of prejudice issue. And it, the treatise said, some courts have suggested that the moving party bears the burden of demonstrating actual prejudice by adverse publicity. And then it cites, for example, State v. Wazaco, 269 Northwest 2nd, 373 Minnesota, 1978. The treatise then continues by stating, although the viability of this view is questionable in light of the decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court in Estes v. Texas and Shepard v. Maxwell. My argument here is I would agree with you. From looking at the Minnesota decisions, they seem to imply that even if you have this presumption of prejudice under the federal constitution, that there's still a requirement to prove actual prejudice. And that's just contrary to the federal court decisions.
Aren't those federal court decisions?
I'm sorry?
Don't those federal court decisions discuss the carnival atmosphere?
They do, because
at the record here, I'm not observing that kind of, quote, carnival atmosphere.
The test under those cases is a totality of the circumstances. So the one case you're describing was the Shepard case where there was a carnival atmosphere. The courts were, for instance, the four factors that were discussed in Skilling were non-exclusive factors. The distinction in this case is there's no other case I've seen where there have been the riots such as we had in Minneapolis prior to the trial of this case, coupled with the extensive security at the courthouse. I've got a red light on.
Yes, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you also will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Judge Reyes, and may it please the court, Neil Katyal for the state of Minnesota. The evidence at trial showed that on May 25th, 2020, George Floyd died at the hands of four police officers. Defendant Derek Chauvin pressed his knees into Floyd's neck and back. Another officer knelt on Floyd's back and held his handcuffed arms. A third restrained his legs. And a fourth held back onlookers who begged the officers to stop. Together, they pushed Floyd down onto the unyielding pavement for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. 9 minutes. 29 seconds. During the first minutes, Floyd pled with Chauvin, saying over 25 times, "I can't breathe." At no point did Chauvin provide Floyd any medical care, even after Floyd stopped breathing and moving, and even after Officer King told Chauvin that Floyd didn't have a pulse.
When did he tell him that, counsel?
Excuse me?
When did he tell him that?
In the course of the events, it was about, I think, about 5 to 6 minutes in.
Okay.
And still, no medical assistance was rendered. What followed, Your Honor, was one of the most transparent and thorough trials in our nation's history. The court and parties painstakingly selected a jury over 2 weeks. 44 witnesses testified. Jurors watched video footage and heard from bystanders. They learned Chauvin was trained against prone restraints because of positional asphyxia, which is the very thing that killed Floyd. And the jury found Floyd guilty on all counts. Now, Chauvin's many arguments before this court do not come close to justifying reversal. There was no abuse of discretion nor actual prejudice. And to the contrary, Judge Cahill managed this trial with enormous care. And even if Chauvin could identify some minor fault, any error is harmless. The evidence of Chauvin's guilt was captured on video for the world to see. I'd like to start with where the court did, the Schwartz hearing. Now, I acknowledge my opponent said that that wasn't the primary issue before the court, but since it's where the court started, I'd like to make 5 points about it. First, Chauvin forfeited this argument before this court and before the district court, and he has to run the table on forfeiture because we're going to be in the land of abuse of discretion, as Your Honor was saying, and indeed plain error review. In the context of Schwartz hearings, he has a special obligation to raise this at the earliest opportunity, and as Judge Reyes, you pointed out, Chauvin had an opportunity to question Juror 52 during voir dire, indeed an extensive opportunity. The transcript reveals 35 pages of questions to Juror 52 during the voir dire, a very extensive process. And as Judge Reyes, you were saying, it's not as if Juror 52 was some sort of closeted Trojan horse that was, you know, designed to, you know, trying to hide his views. He was as forthright as possible, time and again, about his views that he had seen police brutality. He believed that the police department discriminated, you know, and that he thought this was a historic case and wanted to be on it. At the same time, he also said he could render an impartial verdict that some of his friends were police officers and law enforcement officers, and the defense made the strategic choice not to strike him. Indeed, they were left with three strikes at the end, three unused peremptories. Judge Cahill gave 18 peremptories to the defense. Normally, he'd be entitled to five. Three of them were left unused. The Warren case says that's a very good indicia that they were satisfied with the claims made with Juror 52. Now, my opponent says that he made many of these claims before the district court, but Judge Reyes, you're absolutely right. The claim that was made before the district court for as to why Juror 52 lied was a claim about whether he had attended any protests in Minneapolis. And obviously, there's no evidence that he did. And that's why I think Judge Cahill denied the Schwartz hearing. So that's the first point. The second is, I think my opponent ignores the procedural posture here. The question is not, would a Schwartz hearing have been a good idea or something like that? You're not independently asking that. You're rather asking the question on appeal, which is, was it an abuse of discretion not to have the Schwartz hearing? And there is deference, very strong deference, given to the trial court. That is what the Benedict case says, and as well, Your Honor, Judge Reyes, what you were pointing out, the Stoeffel case says that as well. The third thing is that I think my opponent's brief misstates the law about Larson, because they quote one sentence from Larson, which says that they can make a prima facie case, but then it goes on to say that the state can rebut that prima facie case, and only if a juror has quote necessarily lied, do you get a Schwartz hearing. And with respect to the question that they are isolating, was there a protest in Minneapolis that you attended? There's no claim that he necessarily lied. And most, I think, the evidence shows an honest mistake. I mean, Juror 52 wasn't trying to hide the ball or anything like that. He was very clear about his views of police brutality and racism, as I said. And the standard for a Schwartz hearing is that he had to have necessarily lied, which I don't think they come close to doing. And it's also important to remember that Juror 52's own explanations in the media stories that they point to explain he didn't lie. The Juror 52 said, quote, it was 100% not a march for Floyd, that it was the 57th anniversary of the MLK anniversary. He said he, quote, did not attend the protest on behalf of George Floyd. When asked whether this could be interpreted as a protest related to Floyd, he said, not even close, not even close.
And, Counsel, you would acknowledge, though, that there were people who were discussing, advocating, and speaking on the death of George Floyd and this particular case here, correct?
Sure, Your Honor, absolutely. But I don't think that makes it a necessary lie. And I think the reason why that question is on the questionnaire, which was formulated with input from both sides, is because you're trying to ferret out someone's attitudes as a juror. Are you trying to see, do they have some sort of bias or predisposition to rule a certain way? And here, Juror 52 was as forthright as one could imagine. If you look at our brief at page 27, it recounts the statements made during the voir dire as well as in the questionnaire all about how he thinks the police are abusive and so on. But what he also says, and he's asked seven times about this, can you render an impartial verdict? And he says yes. And indeed, one of the questions by my adversary is to Juror 52 is, well, what about all these protests? Can you still render a fair verdict? And he says, absolutely. The protests are very different things than the facts of this specific case. So they've made a strategic choice to leave Juror 52 on at a point when they still have unused peremptories. And I don't think now they can bait and switch and say, well, we got it wrong. And, Juror 52, we should have a Schwartz hearing. As Judge Reyes, your first question to my adversary was, you had the opportunity at voir dire to follow up, particularly when you have these extensive answers that say he believes the police are racist, he's seen incidences of police abuse and the like.
Assuming we might disagree with you, how do you propose that we would handle a remand for a Schwartz hearing?
Yeah, I think you would remand for only the Schwartz hearing and nothing else. I'd caution the court very strongly against that, because if you do that here, then you're going to have it in every high-profile case. Remember, Your Honor, the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Larson case said that you have to be careful about accusations against jurors, and this was before an age of social media. I mean, if what they've done here, this kind of sandbagging is permitted, in every high-profile case, the defense, after a guilty verdict, will scrutinize the jurors' Twitter, Facebook, social media.
I appreciate that argument. My query is more to what do we do with the rest of the issues on appeal?
Yeah, so I think you wouldn't necessarily have to decide them. I think you could just remand for the Schwartz hearing and leave those to another day. We do think the other issues are so clear, you might as well just decide them now. I'm happy to turn to the other issue he focused on, venue, but I'm also happy to answer any other Schwartz questions first.
I actually have a different question on the cumulative testimony. You had seven witnesses testify. Why isn't that piling on? Why isn't that considered cumulative?
Well, I think the judge has massive discretion there. And as we say, the State versus Bobo case says that for the central issues in a case, there isn't any such thing as cumulative testimony. And here, reasonable use of force was the central issue in the case.
I'm sorry, can you state that again in terms of what case are you talking about?
State versus Bobo. It is cited in our brief, Your Honor. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case. And it basically says, for central issues, there's a different standard for what is cumulative and what isn't. We also don't think that it would be reversible error under any circumstance, because cumulative just simply means that's more additional evidence. There's no case that says you would reverse or something because of the presentation of cumulative testimony. And that's particularly so here, because each of the seven witnesses testified from a different perspective. And remember, the defense was trying to pick off each of these witnesses, attacking them. They said, for example, Chief Arredondo was just a desk officer, an administrator. He hadn't been in the field. And they said, another witness was a national standards expert and wasn't relevant, even though this court's decision in Knorr permitted it. So they were trying to attack each one of these, and that's why we as the state did present a comprehensive picture to the jury of this central issue in the case.
Well, you also argued in your brief that you thought that any effect of it would be cumulative. Any cumulative effect would be harmless. And you cited the McDonald Richards case, but I'm not sure I read that case the same way that you do. I don't think it analyzed whether evidence was objected to as cumulative, but whether the error was inadmissible statement was harmless because it was cumulative of other evidence. That's a different standard. than what we have here.
We quite agree with that, Your Honor. I think our point is that Rule 403's prohibition on cumulative testimony, it's really about efficiency concerns, and there aren't cases that say that you reverse because of the presentation of cumulative evidence. And we'd also point out here that Judge Cahill was very solicitous of the concerns about cumulative testimony and indeed restricted our ability to use these witnesses because of that concern. So I think what Judge Cahill did was absolutely in the heartland of what trial court discretion is all about. You'd really have to find an abuse of discretion for the first time on cumulative testimony. And here, again, each of the witnesses testified for a distinct perspective and in a circumstance in which the defense was trying to pick off each of the different witnesses saying that they weren't qualified or something like that. You know, and so that's why we decided to present that full picture to the jury on that central issue.
Counsel, appellant cites to a lot of the case law related to having too many expert witnesses. Could you clarify for me how many of these witnesses were called as expert witnesses and how many were called as fact witnesses?
Yeah, I believe that there were 7 witnesses called. In the one case that they cite, Deshay, I don't think comes close to saying what they are saying. That was about a gang witness that was testifying. And indeed, at page 888, the court says that that expert testimony, quote, may add precision or depth to the jury's ability to reach conclusions about matters that are not within their experience. And indeed, the bottom line of Deshay is very much supportive of our position. If I could just say a few words about venue, because that is where that is the our argument that my friends wanted to start with. And I'd say 5 things. First is that they don't meet the standard, as Judge Reyes, you were suggesting, of clear abuse of discretion and actual prejudice. Presumed prejudice has almost never happened. Your Honor, as you were saying, the one example is Shepard. And in Shepard, what the U.S. Supreme Court said is even in that bedlam proceeding, if a trial judge managed it correctly through voir dire and through instructions to the jury, even with that bedlam, that would have been permissible. Here, the district court used extensive procedures for a fair trial, the jury questionnaires, individual voir dire lasting 2 weeks. The Skilling case, the U.S. Supreme Court held it with a 5-hour voir dire in a far more carnival-like atmosphere than the one that was going on in this case. There were 18 strikes given to them. The Warren case says, on venue challenges, if you have unused strikes left at the end, that's a very good indicia that the defense was happy with the jury. And most importantly, they never deal with what we say at page 16 of our brief and the 3 Minnesota Supreme Court cases, Blum and Parker and Thompson, which say the relevant question is not was there kind of security concern or pretrial publicity in one area. If that pretrial publicity was going to blanket the state, then there is no advantage to shifting venue. And here, Judge Cahill specifically answered what you heard today about the security concerns and the barbed wire and the like. What he said is, and this is quoted in our brief at page 16, that having the trial at the Hennepin County Government Center would be safer and reassure the jury and make them more impartial, not less, because the security could be folded into a general security over the city. And even if you had trial in some other place in Minnesota in a smaller venue, he said the security would stand out and you'd have the same fears of civil unrest there. And so he's made all of those findings on the record at document 192 at page 4 to 5.
Counsel, I have one more question that I'd like you to address briefly, and that is whether a police officer can be convicted of a second-degree felony murder involving the predicate felony of third-degree assault and discuss reasonable force as well as whether or not that creates a strict liability, which is, I believe, appellant's argument.
Yes, absolutely. So that argument will be reviewed on plain error. It's not an argument that they made below. And we think that that kind of 007 license to kill idea is absurd, because even if you spotted everything in their legal argument about how police officers generally couldn't be guilty of felony murder, here Chauvin acted with special danger to the individual, the jury found.
The special danger, I mean, that goes to appellant's argument, though, that there should have been a jury instruction, which the district court denied. Are you saying that the district court did abuse its discretion then by denying the request for a special danger jury instruction?
No, the district court did everything right. There's no need for an instruction because the Minnesota Supreme Court on two different occasions, in the Anderson case and in the Cole case, have said that when it's a crime against the person, you don't need any sort of special danger instruction. Your Honor, what I was saying was you don't even need to get there as to the question of whether there's a special danger instruction that was required or not, because okay. Here the jury necessarily found that in finding the second degree manslaughter conviction of Chauvin. And so there's case after case that says that when there's an assault, that is a predicate felony for the felony murder doctrine. And my opponent's argument on the other side is to say, well, that'll be a strict liability offense for police officers. That is absolutely wrong. Unreasonable use of force is always required. That's always the safeguard against this. And, you know, if anything, the Graham standard, which has been incorporated into Minnesota law, has been criticized as being too friendly to police officers. But here, that's what the jury was instructed on. The jury absolutely found that under that standard, Derek Chauvin acted with unreasonable force, 9 minutes and 29 seconds on this on George Floyd's neck.
Any questions, Judge Larson? Judge Klopak? Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I want to start off the rebuttal by dealing with the second degree murder charge. Nobody is suggesting that there's any 007 thing. The problem with using the felony murder rule under the second degree murder statute is there's no intent. There's no intent instruction.
Well, there's an intent instruction. There's a general intent instruction because you have the assault. That's a general intent offense.
Fair enough. I'm sorry. The problem with a police officer, the intent instruction for assault, and I don't want to waste a lot of time on this, is the intent to touch. Minnesota Supreme Court has held it's not the intent to injure somebody. And the problem with a police officer when they are arresting somebody is they have to touch them. So you basically eliminate the intent.
Right, but you still have the reasonable standard, and that's under the statutes as well.
That's correct, but that's an objective standard. I mean, it's unusual to have a murder charge with no finding by or no instruction of the jury of any kind of subjective intent of the defendant. That's the argument we were making.
Right. It is an objective standard, but I think what your argument, I understand your argument to be a strict liability, it creates a strict liability for police officers.
Yes.
But the Dorn case seems to undercut that argument, doesn't it?
I disagree with that analysis because of the way the felony murder statute is set up in Minnesota on assault. As we've laid out in our papers, Minnesota is a minority of jurisdictions where assault, most states do not allow felony murder where the predicate felony is an assault.
Right. And I understand that argument, but we're an error-correcting court. If that is going to change, that has to be changed by the Minnesota Supreme Court or the legislature. That's not for us to change that.
And I made that clear in my brief.
Okay.
I said that in my brief. I just don't want to get up to the Minnesota Supreme Court and say, why didn't you raise this below? You waived it.
Fair enough.
I made it clear in my brief that you're bound by that precedent.
Okay. Fair enough, counsel.
I want to get back to the venue issue. I want to make a couple of points with it regarding to the presumption of prejudice. Number one, it's not subject to any kind of abuse of discretion standard. That is a de novo review. I spent quite a bit of time reading the Skilling case, and one of the things I've done in my career, which may sound a little bit odd, at times I've used statements by the dissents in cases because the dissent sometimes will more accurately or concisely convey what the majority did. So in the Skilling case, Justice Sotomayor wrote the dissent. She made very clear in the dissent that there's this presumption of prejudice standard that you have to go through first. But one of the quotes I wanted to cite from her dissent was, she stated, as I cited earlier, the Estes and Shepard cases. This is the quote from the case. Estes and Shepard thus applied Rideau's, another Supreme Court case, insight that in particularly extreme circumstances, even the most rigorous voir dire cannot suffice to dispel the reasonable likelihood of jury bias. That analysis shows that this has to be a de novo standard. In other words, the pervasiveness of the publicity, and in this particular case, combined with the physical threats in the courthouse, provide an environment that the Supreme Court has held, you can't trust the voir dire at that point.
Why does it have to be a de novo standard? Why can't it still be an abuse of discretion of whether the district court abused its discretion by continuing to hold the trial in that venue or not allowing a continuance or not sequestering the jury? It seems like those are all under the abuse of discretion standard, aren't they?
Typically, abuse of discretion applies when a trial judge is evaluating some kind of testimony and weighing.
Well, it's more than that. It's also for evidentiary hearings, evidentiary issues, I'm sorry, as well as basically trial management.
Correct. I understand that. We were both talking.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And a motion to transfer venue, that's up to the discretion of the district court as to whether or not to grant that motion.
Not under the first tier that I laid out. I'm getting really short on time. One factor
That's okay. And just to let you know, if you need a little bit more time to answer this question, that's fine.
Thank you. I'm sorry, do I have a question pending?
I see where you're coming from, but I think isn't the overarching standard of review abuse of discretion, but a district court can abuse its discretion if it applies the law erroneously. So I see your argument in terms of whether or not the district court appropriately applied the law, but isn't that under the abuse of discretion standard?
No, it's de novo. And the reason I laid out the quote from the Skilling case was the trial court's judge's analysis of voir dire is subject to abuse of discretion because the judge is watching the jurors and the like. As Justice Sotomayor laid out in the dissent, coming from the majority opinion, the Rideau case, there are some cases that are so extreme that even rigorous voir dire is not going to overcome a juror's bias. That to me reflects the fact that it has to be a de novo standard because the jury voir dire doesn't matter. Before I end, the one last thing I wanted to say, and I wanted to say this at the beginning, the other problem with this case that makes it very unique is Mr. Keitel laid out that no matter where this case got moved, it wouldn't matter because people would know about it and the like. The difference here is the jurors that sat on this jury had a stake in the outcome of the case because they lived here where the riots occurred. If this case gets moved out state, the likelihood of having riots in the community where the jurors are living, I believe, will be zero. Thank you.
Judge Larson, Judge Klopak, any other questions? We ran a little bit over, but I want to make sure that you had the opportunity to answer the question fully. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for both parties, thank you very much for the briefing. It was very extensive, very thorough, and we appreciate that. Oral arguments were excellent. We will be issuing our opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you all. Take care and stay safe.